I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
I love talking with farmers. You've probably gleaned that by now since this is my 3rd year doing it. And I think it just gets better. The more you know, the more you want to know. The more I talk with farmers, the more I am convinced that they hold the keys to the castle. Do you know what I mean? Well, after you hear from rancher Glenn Elzinga today, you will. You will see solutions taking shape. Why can't we apply these tested theories more widely? Let's talk about this later. For now, welcome to Talk Farm to Me. I'm your host, Farm Girl, or Dana if you prefer. I think this is going to be the best year yet. I can't wait for you to meet the farmers I have lined up for you. Honest conversations with serious farmers. They have passion and experience, and they tell us so much more than just about the world of farming. You'll see. You are the key to all of this, by the way. It's that old, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it riddle. You listening today from your car, while you do errands, while you have a quiet moment, it matters. You are showing up for farmers. They can't be invisible if you see them. So, good job. Today you meet rancher Glenn Elzinga of Alder Spring Ranch in May, Idaho. He raises cattle on his ranch and in the hills. And I do mean hills. And he sells 100% organic grass-fed beef to consumers nationwide. Today's conversation is about listening, about relationships, about observations, and rethinking paradigms. It's about possibilities. And I swear it's about his ranch as well. Glenn is full of energy and ideas, and he tests them and makes some fascinating discoveries. This also makes him a fidgety interview, and I didn't have the heart to tell him to sit still. So you'll hear him getting excited. I hope it puts your wheels in motion too. Glenn is a first-generation rancher on Alder Spring Ranch in the Pocimaroy Valley of Idaho. He's first-generation. Sorta. His father was a grass cattle farmer in Europe with generations of farming in his DNA. Glenn was thinking that nearly 900 to 1200 years of farming ancestry. But his father was disillusioned by farming in the United States when he arrived, and he went into trucking instead. He immigrated around the time of the Green Revolution when we were expanding agricultural production dramatically with chemicals. Other members of Glenn's family continued. This is where his story begins. As a kid, visiting the farms of family members in the Northeast made such an impression on him.
And so it kind of cemented in me that, hey, this is what I want to come back to. I just loved it. I just loved the idea of husbandry. I loved the idea of animals on the land.
That early exposure, before he became a rancher, before he got his degree in forestry, before he met and married his wife Carol, a doctor of plant ecology, and had 7 daughters before Alder Spring Ranch. That early influence really stuck with him.
What did you do before this?
So I was in agriculture, working on various kinds of Maybe it was a greenhouse established. Maybe it was a tree nursery. There's plenty of muck farms in there, plenty of dairy farms in there, all the way to the age of 20. And then I basically got chemical saturated, went to bed sick a lot, had a lot of burn disorders associated with my skin from chemical use. Back in that day, Dana, you know, during the Green Revolution, I was working with people who would routinely prove that these things were innocuous to humans by drinking them on the job. They'd say, malathion, I'm going to drink it.
Malathion is an insecticide in the chemical family known as organophosphates. Products containing malathion are used outdoors to control a wide variety of insects in agricultural settings and around people's homes. It's been used to control mosquitoes and fruit flies, as well as in some special shampoos for treating lice. It was first registered for use in the United States in 1956. Short-term exposures to high levels of malathion can affect the nervous system, causing a variety of symptoms, including headaches, nausea, dizziness, weakness, cramps, diarrhea, excessive sweating, blurred vision, and an increased heart rate.
Who knows if they're still alive today? I guess I'm kind of wondering what kind of cancer they have. So we'd be out there in a pair of cutoff shorts and work boots, just spraying everything under the sun. I mean, there was no idea that this stuff could actually be toxic to you and your future family and the next generation, let alone what it was probably doing to the soil. That wasn't even on the table. This was the Green Revolution. Everything was a go. It was all for the sake of production. So we're just putting all this stuff on and we're getting sick every night and we come back and do it all over again the next day. And I just got pretty sick from that and sick of it. And I just wanted to get out. So I quit and I went to school for forestry because forestry had this thing that you were actually working in kind of a wild, semi-functional system. I wasn't into the tree farm forestry at all. I was really into the ecological harvest. And so that's what I went to school for, became a forest ecologist, practiced that for 15 years.
Just myth-busting here a little. If you think farmers are undereducated, think again. Glenn and his wife, Carol, both hold degrees in science, forestry, and environmental studies with a concentration in native plants and ecology, major chops that they apply to the craft of raising 100% organic grass-fed cattle on their ranch. I can't tell if it's their training or their nature that makes the Elzingas so observant, a trait and a practice that becomes apparent and central to their work the more you listen. Let's continue.
And in that time, I actually grew to hate cows because I became a public lands forester here in the Pacific Northwest. And up here, we live in a county the size of Connecticut, 97% of it is public land. Okay, 3% is private land. So it's complete flip-flop from a place like New England or Connecticut, Vermont. But, you know, actually during forestry, I developed this incredible hatred for cows because, like I said, on this public lands, they're all grazed. They're all grazed public lands with people permitted to run livestock up there. And I really grew to hate them because as a forester, we'd put these, maybe we put a plantation in, or maybe we do a thinning project, or maybe we do this ecological release project where we create riparian area buffers around wet areas and springs and stuff.
Okay, Glenn, riparian area buffers, what the heck? Let me help for a second. A riparian buffer is an area near a stream, lake, or wetland that has a combination of trees, shrubs, and perennial plants that is managed differently from the rest of the surrounding landscape, mostly for land conservation reasons.
And we go see cows go in there and just turn it into a nuclear waste zone where they end up for the summer because somebody's not managing them. And it's just cows behaving badly. It's not the cow's fault, but I did end up hating cows.
Glenn runs cattle now for a living, about 650 head of them on 50,000 acres. And if you think his experience hating cows, hating the havoc they wreaked on the landscape, and hating the mismanagement of these herds didn't have an impact on him, think again. It did. A big, deep one.
So super ironically, this little ranch comes up for sale with seven cows on it and 145 acres. And Carol and I, my wife Carol, PhD, plant ecologist, botanist, but she raised on a corn and soybean farm in the Midwest in Indiana. she's got the same kind of level of frustration with agriculture as practitioners on these wildlands in the West. You know, we kind of found our niche there, but we had these agricultural roots, and we both had a real love for trying to have something that was ours that we could practice and learn husbandry on small scale.
For many young aspiring farmers today, a couple of decades later, finding land is the number one barrier to getting started in farming. The 2022 National Young Farmer Survey found that the top challenge cited by young farmers is land access, and this barrier is increasing. 59% of young farmers named finding affordable land to buy as very or extremely challenging, an increase from the 39% who cited it as a significant challenge in 2017. Glenn has more to say on this barrier later. You'll see.
So 7 cows, 145 acres, that seemed perfect. The place was paradise. What was the best part of it was there was an old couple that we bought it from, and they'd been ranching all their lives. And just salt of the earth, just the blood of the land and theirs was the same. They were pre-Green Revolution, and they were skeptical of all these things. They lived with the elk, the antelope, the deer, the beavers, the bears. They just loved them all, and they lived in a kind of an ecosystem with them. And it wasn't perfect in terms of managing for the ecological whole, but they were trying their very best with what knowledge they had, and they were just doing a great job of it. We looked at that place, and we just fell in love because there's all this functional habitat in a ranch, and it was unusual that we were seeing that. And so we just fell in love with them. We fell in love with the place, and we said to them, hey, how about we give you a lifetime stay? You can stay here for as long as you live, if you're willing to have a conversation with us every now and then, because we don't know anything.
Traditionally, farmer mentoring was passed down from parent to child. Now many aging farmers find that their children don't want to take over the family farm, and farms quietly fade away. The Elzingas found an interesting relationship through their land purchase, which included mentoring. Now some organizations, from the USDA to SCORE, a national volunteer agency, to other nonprofits, provide new farmer mentoring.
And so they did. And so we did. And it was just this entirely happy time. They were able to put into our kids that we started having while we lived there. And we just started from 100% scratch. We had $30,000 in the bank from those jobs. So that was our down payment. And then we just got into a direct mortgage with them. And people today say prices have gone to the point where, you know, that can no longer be done. Through relationships, anything can happen. Dana, anything can happen if you have relationship. And it isn't only relationship with a person, a practitioner on the land, that maybe an old couple you buy a place from or something like that. It's relationship with the land, obviously. It's relationship with those animals. It's relationship with the wildlife, but also relationship with other partners in terms of people. Like for the current ranch we're on, we partnered with the Nature Conservancy.
The Nature Conservancy is a global environmental organization headquartered in Arlington, Virginia. As of 2021, it works via affiliates or branches in 79 countries and territories, as well as across every state in the U.S. The mission of the Nature Conservancy is to conserve the lands and waters on which all life depends. Their vision is to have a world where the diversity of life thrives and people act to conserve nature for its own sake and its ability to fulfill our needs and enrich our lives.
They wanted the development rights. We didn't. And we just paid for the land, for the right to farm it and right to live on it, right to own it. But we gave up our development rights in the transaction. And they wanted that to ensure open space and habitat. So it was it's a relationship.
Just in case you are thinking this relationship thing is just a kumbaya sensibility, let's remember that Glenn is running a business. A startup, if you will, but one with a goal toward feeding his family and turning a profit.
Anything is possible, given relationship. And profitability in agriculture is the same thing. For us, it took a long time to figure out what it looked like, but it was about relationship with the land and relationship with those soil organisms underneath our feet that actually began to drive our profit center and make us not only productive, but profitable. Because when the soil organisms are working for you, when that soil underneath your feet starts working for you, it's not an input on our part. We're not throwing chemicals on it. It's actually a soil that's like exponentially increasing in productivity. And that exponential increase at first came, it stealthed into our existence. We didn't even know it because exponential curves go like this. They become very steep.
You can imagine Glenn gesticulating here, right? It's that active mind, active body fidget component kicking in.
But there's this low level increase, slow gradient, that's very imperceptible. So when we started practicing adaptive planned grazing, basically a management intensive grazing and stopping continuous grazing on both the wildlands we run on and our home place. And this was even on that first ranch. We started to see like things like biodiversity started expanding. We started to see plants we didn't even know we had, but there was a seed bank there. And we allowed it to express when we created a soil biology underneath it to allow it to express. So that became very exciting because when that diversity started happening, our productivity increased and we didn't realize it. Nobody even was talking about this at that time. When you increase plant diversity above ground, your biodiversity underground exponentially increases to follow the linear progression of what's happening above ground. So you have an exponential increase of soil life. You have these fungal networks that go not for millimeters or centimeters. They go for meters and sub-kilometers. They'll go for 1,000 meters across a place, these fungal hyphae networks of all these interrelated species that are connecting mycorrhizally with your above-ground plants.
You can see where his and his wife Carol's expertise in plant ecology, botany, and forestry have had an influence over what the Elzingas are seeing and experiencing and give them the tools to talk about it scientifically.
So you have this exponential expression of transference of nutrients across the soil profile. And when you do that, you're going to start to see dramatic increases in the productivity and wellness that your plants provide to the animals that are walking on top.
You just know, like so much knowledge, obviously you and your wife are both scientists, very well studied in all of this. When you're talking about that gentle curve before it becomes super obvious.
Yes.
What happens in that period? Do you have to be really well trained to see that? Or was it just kind of like gradually, like one day, how do you maintain patience while you're doing what you're doing,
That's great. That's a fantastic question, because during the like slow growth part of the curve, you know, we're working full time, sometimes two full time jobs along with ranching full time. And we were on borrowed money. We had no money. We just walked into a bank one time. I remember the banker, he's become a friend of mine since. I don't know if you should ever be friends with a banker while you're getting involved with a banker. But anyway, subsequent to that, he's always asked how we're doing. But anyway, he follows me out to the door and he hands me a check. It's loan money for $150,000. And he shakes my hand and he says, Glenn, one of two things are going to happen with this money. And I said, what are they, Tom? And he said, I've given you enough money that hopefully if you're wise with it and you follow your plan like we've talked about, I think you might be able to pull this off. But he said, this is just enough money to completely hang you and your family and you'll never make it. So it's one of those two things that's going to happen. So anyway, he was no like economic savior mentality of, oh, this borrowed money is going to save you up. You know, he was totally transparent about what borrowed money can do to you. So I was not a big fan of borrowed money, but it was the only way to get started because we had none. So that's a stress in itself while this thing is happening, because you're like, I got to pay the loan. I get a land payment. I get a cow payment. I got to make that somehow out of this money that we're generating off this place. But Dana, the fact of the matter is, when you're scaling up, trying to learn at the same time, there really is no money because you're making all these huge cost investments in the school of ranching, right? Because I don't care even if you got an ag degree, learn a type of ranching that's going to have the land be your partner, you know, that soil biology be your partner in your operation, there's no like college that's going to teach you all those things more than experience and just watching and observing both the land and the animals on top of it and learning from them and letting them teach you and learning from these old husbandry practitioners, you know, these old people on the land, most of now who unfortunately are passing. Those things don't make you money. Okay. You're going to school the whole time. On beginning agriculturist, I would say never quit your job. Keep the job going. You don't got to quietly quit, but keep the job going, keep working, because you do need an income stream to subsidize your existence while you're embarking. You know, we were 30, Dana. It didn't matter. We could work our ass off and it just didn't matter. I remember sleeping along an irrigation ditch in the middle of the night, just falling down from exhaustion at 2 o'clock in the morning, because I know the water's going to get changed and I'm going to be there for it at 3 or 4 a.m. Then I'm going to fall into bed for 2 hours, then go to work for my full-time job. Okay. So that was the reality. That was a high sacrifice thing. Carol was doing the same thing. She was running full-time ecological contracts. We'd find somebody to watch the cattle for a week and we'd disappear up into the wilderness south of Glacier Park in Montana. And we'd live in the backcountry for a week and nail a plant or vegetative forest contract up there in the backcountry. We'd knock it off and we'd work 15, 16 hour days, come back and go back to our other, you know, so we just did that to subsidize our existence while this thing's happening. You talked about while this thing, before the exponential starts actually yielding.
Meanwhile, you have a family. You have just a few daughters.
7 Elzinga daughters are all involved in the ranching business in one way or another. Maybe we'll have some of them on Talk Farm to me at some point in the future. I'm pretty sure they have some amazing stories to tell.
Yes. I guess we like those because we kept producing them.
So tell me about, they don't have to live through this shallow curve because, you know, you brought the farm up and you've taught them so much. So as those farmers whose farm you bought and learned from.
Yes.
Now your girls have a leg up. Tell me what the future looks like for them and for your ranch.
So they do have a leg up because they're actually really seeing it now. You talk about our ecological experience before this and being able, you know what? I don't care if you're a welder, a plumber, or if you're a writer, or you have absolutely no ecological training. I don't think you need that to be able to see. So I want to make sure that people know that you don't need that to have eyes to be able to learn from what this land's telling you or learn from what your animals. For instance, I took the kids, 2 of the girls and 2 of my full-time ranch cowboys out to look at these cattle. It's been sub-zero for 2 weeks here. Every night it goes below zero. I think the lowest it hit was 14 below zero. This morning it was only like 2 below zero. And we're still grazing. We're not feeding hay yet. And we got some snow on the ground. These cattle are all spread out on what we call a false stockpile. You can pull away the snow and you can still see green under there. It's freeze-dried green, but it's still green. And I said, so what do you guys think? Do you think that we need to start feeding hay? And they thought about it for a while. And Melanie said, I guess I don't think we need to be feeding hay. And I said, why not? She said, because the cattle aren't telling us that we need to feed them hay. So that kind of thing, those cattle see us. And normally, if they're ready to move, they will come up to us immediately and say, we're ready to move. There's not a lot of nuance on that one, Dana. That's like our cattle are all scattered out. They all are cognizant of us being in the field with them. So you don't need ecological training to say, do the cows want to move or not? No, they all get their heads down. They're happy. They're grazing. Some are laying in sunshine in the afternoon. They don't want to move. They're good to go. They don't need hay. We're good. We can just listen to them. And the grass can tell us those kind of things too. It's just about getting that eye tuned in. So you don't got to be some kind of crazy scientist person or whatever, or have all kinds of husbandry background, because husbandry is something, it's in all of our genome. And I think it's like being willing to listen and learn. That's really what this is about. It's listening and learning to what nature will tell us.
I feel that here for sure. I have, like I said, very limited experience, but sometimes people ask me about things on the farm and I'm like, I have instincts. and they're very loud. I don't ignore them. I have that feeling and I go and I look at my donkey. I was like, Murphy's sick. Something's wrong with him. I think he has Lyme or he has some sort of tick-borne illness. This is what I'm telling you. And I'm right. I just know.
Exactly. Yeah, but it's because you paid attention.
You don't need a farm to put these instincts and observations to work. They're actually quite useful on your own body. Listen to your body. A lesson from the farm. And also another way to connect to a farm through good food to nourish it.
Exactly. It was like that with Carolyn. We've both had a huge food allergy path. Food just not agreeing with us for a lot of our lives. Maybe it was some of the chemical exposure or something. I don't know. But we were totally screwed up. And it wasn't until we really started trying to listen to our body. And what I found out was when I put something in my mouth that I wasn't supposed to be eating, if I could just take a second and listen, my body would actually say, don't eat that, or don't take another bite of that, because that's not going to work out. And some people think that's ludicrous because they're going down to Burger King, they're at the drive-thru, and they're going to order the whatever you order at. I guess it's Whoppers at Burger King, right? I used to eat them. That's why I can speak with experience, because I used to go through that drive-thru and be indiscriminate about what I was putting into my body and just shut all the nuance of listening to what your body might be telling you about what's good and what's not.
I feel like this episode is about so much more than Glenn's story or farming. It's about these big, simple ideas, like listening, that if applied well, can transform how you live your life. Are you feeling that? Of course, it also applies to Glenn and Alder Spring Ranch.
It's the exact same thing with listening to the land. We just got to shut up, get out of our paradigm, the county agent paradigm that says, hey, you need to fertilize. You need to fertilize here. I saw a poor guy the other day. He's going to worm all his calves because he's got liver flukes in him. And he's got to worm them and he's got to try to kill all these liver flukes in him.
Liver flukes sound bad, right? And certainly a P in the A for a rancher. Definitely not something you want. Liver flukes come from eating a parasitic larva from vegetation in contaminated water. Basically, the larva goes through the digestive system, through the walls of the intestines, to the liver. That's what it eats. This is more than you need to know, but the eggs of the liver flukes are pooped out and spread like that. Just so you know.
And I felt bad for the guy because he was stuck. That was the answer for him. Instead of trying to figure out, he was stuck in that paradigm of chemical agriculture. And those are the solutions. Instead of saying, wait, liver flukes have always been here. Okay. And wait, we have elk and deer and moose and bison that lived here for millennia before we came on. Why didn't they all die from liver fluke?
Again, life lessons. The point here is not liver flukes. Instead, it's finding good solutions from nature.
Or like calving, for instance. Every one of my neighbors, winter or early spring calves, they got snow. They got no green grass. And Carol and I are going down the road one day, and we're looking at these baby elk. We have tons of elk around us here. And they're all calving in May and June, right? Green grass, wildflowers, bees are buzzing. That's when they calve, and it's so finally that hit us with a ton of bricks and said, wait, what do elk and deer do? They wait till green grass to calve. Let's do that with our calf. Talk about removing stress. But see, we were stuck in a paradigm before that. So there's all kinds of paradigms, you know, food paradigms, green revolution paradigms, chemical paradigms. This is how the neighbors do it paradigms. This is how granddad did it paradigms. This is how everybody I know does this. Why do you guys got to be different paradigms? Those things, we just need to rethink all those things and say and test them against what's nature doing in this situation? How does nature keep regenerating itself over millennia? How do these animals live here and thrive? And if we could get that in our head, then we can reap that beauty in productivity and profitability, because it's not about us putting inputs in that costs a lot of money. It's about us just watching nature do this.
So there's a word that you mentioned in all of that, that is, I think, the biggest question. And that's if. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
What can agriculture in all of its current paradigms learn from what you're doing? And how do we address this on a large scale? Is it possible? Is the if possible?
No, the if is so possible. It's about paradigms, not only in terms of each producer. And that's really where it's got to start. It's got to start at each producer. Worldwide, farming is an extremely marginal enterprise, extremely capital intensive, right? Even for us, we don't have all kinds of big tractors or anything like that. Our newest tractor is a 1984 model. So we don't invest a lot in big iron or anything like that. That's not what we're about. But yet the land under our feet is very capital intensive, right? Yet I do know practitioners who are regenerative who don't own anything. They don't own a cow. They don't own land, but they're really checking all the boxes as far as regenerative productivity, and they're profitable when they do that. We throw up these typical roadblocks that say, wait, I'm a farmer, I'm in the Midwest, this is the way everybody does it, this is the whole cost structure, this is how the bank's going to finance me. But what if instead we said to him, hey, we'd really like you to be regenerative and we'd like to support you in that. What if we helped you for 5 years and get your feet under you and explore this possibility? Explore the possibility. That's, for me, that's even a bigger word than if, because just tendering that there's possibility there is exciting to me, when instead we often say that's not possible, that's impossible. But what if these things were possible?
I have this strong opinion that I share with you here because it's something I am learning by listening to farmers over the years. It's this, and I think Glenn is underscoring it here. I believe that there are solutions embedded in agriculture for all of the problems that we foist on agriculture. It involves listening to the land, to the animals, to nature, and to farmers. It's definitely about if we listen to them. If we do, we will see what's possible.
So that's what Carol and I did actually on our range. We were getting on a wild range as we graze on. There's 46,000 acres up there, about 70 square miles that we run on. And the wolves had started eating our calves like crazy. And one year we lost about $33,000 in calves because the wolves happened to like organic grass-fed beef. And they wanted to be first in the supply chain. So they just started eating them. And we were like, I don't know what we're gonna do here. So when we got our head wrapped around the fact that we can maybe learn something from these wolves, I picked up the phone one afternoon and called this friend of mine, Mark Davidson. He was working at the Nature Conservancy, the local chapter. And I said, hey, Mark, I have an idea. And he said, what's the idea? I said, what if you helped us for 3 to 5 years with some funding to try to figure out how to reinvent a shepherding protocol to where our team would live with the cattle up on the range and we wouldn't get into this lethal interaction between wolves and us, and we just live with them. We'd learn to live with them. And while we're doing it, we restored all the streamside habitat up there and all the fish habitat by not letting our cattle graze those areas. And he's 100% no-brainer. So Nature Conservancy partnered with us for the three first years. Then a local range network that we are a member of partnered with us for two more. So for 5 years, Dana, we were subsidized because, you know what? It's the weirdest thing. This is one of the oldest professions on earth, is shepherding and herding, right? We could trace it back thousands of years. In the Old Testament of the Bible, all these herders, they're running tens of thousands of sheep and goats and whatnot. And it struck us like a ton of bricks. It's like, holy cow, we don't even know how to do that anymore. We know how to move cattle from point A to point B. There's a real good cowboy culture that moves cattle, but there's no culture that feeds cattle and feeds sheep and husbands them to the best nutrition and the best wellness for them and for the land and for the water quality and for the fish and all these things. And so it really did take us that long to figure it out, because we had to figure out everything, and not only the herding techniques, but how to put people in the backcountry for weeks at a time, how to set up remote cow camps that were zero impact, how to run electric hot wire up there, portable, that was totally movable, how to get up remote stock water systems, how to GPS all these cattle locations over time so that we could hack that year after year by looking at our GPS results of where we grazed. And so it was really worth it for us. But now, guess what? There's no more subsidy. We're just running out of pocket now, because it's now something that we can break even on in terms of what it would have been just running at home on private pasture. So that's what I'm talking about with farmers and ranchers. It's, hey, Glenn and Carol could not figure this out on our own without some financial help, because we're going to have to throw a lot of money at employees and trying to hack things and trying to figure out partners that would help us learn how to do these things.
If you don't think this is amazing, this effort, this level of scrutiny and searching for possibilities, I don't know if I can dish amazing up to you, honestly. Can you imagine picking up what you're doing right now and trying to figure out a new and better way on 100 interrelated factors and doing it on horseback in the mountains? This is the if I was talking about, that if. And it's married with the potential for possibility. I get this feeling of deep awe every time I talk with a farmer. It's a thread I want you to feel too.
And it's the exact same thing in agriculture. What if we partnered with farmers and ranchers and said, hey, you know what? You might not even believe in these attributes, carbon sequestration, organic matter creation, and profitability off of soils. But we want to help you get there. And we want you to have some flexibility in your economics to be able to learn that part of your operation and how to be truly sustainable for not only your family and yourself, but also in a global context by actually putting more carbon in the ground than you're releasing.
I feel like it might be a good moment to take a pause and talk about carbon sequestration. We hear this term thrown around all the time, and I don't think we all really know what it means. Glenn knows, but I think if I share a little, it might be helpful to your thinking. Doing a deep dive helped me. Atmospheric carbon dioxide comes from two primary sources, natural and human activities. Natural sources of carbon dioxide include most animals, which exhale carbon dioxide as a waste product. Human activities that lead to carbon dioxide emissions come primarily from energy production, including burning coal, oil, or natural gas. Carbon dioxide is the most commonly produced greenhouse gas. Carbon sequestration is the process of capturing and storing atmospheric carbon dioxide. It is one method of reducing the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere with the goal of reducing global climate change. Forests and woodlands are considered one of the best forms of natural carbon sequestration. Carbon dioxide binds to plants during photosynthesis, exchanging it for oxygen as a purifying emission. While livestock, like cattle, produce a great deal of greenhouse gases, the grasslands that they graze also have the capacity to store those gases and prevent them from being redistributed into the air. If cows are left to graze one area of pasture continuously, they can eat the grass down to the ground, disturbing stores of carbon. If cows are rotated between different areas of pasture, then those stores can remain intact, halting further emissions from those sources. Rotational grazing allows cows to get the nutrients they need and maintains the health of the grass and soil over the long term, all while keeping carbon in the ground instead of releasing it into the atmosphere. With a rotational grazing system, there's less need to feed cows grain or artificially fertilize the grass, so fertilization comes from the cows pooping in the grass. In some cases, farms that use rotational grazing can produce 19% fewer emissions than other farms in the first 2 years, dropping to 35% fewer emissions after participating for longer than 2 years. Glenn is very tuned into this.
I just wanted to find out, Dana, where we stood, because I guess I didn't feel right about selling our product. It's 100% organic grass-fed, and it's really weird to not be able to say to somebody, hey, we have a negative carbon footprint. Instead, I'd have to say, I don't know, or worst case scenario, you know, we're actually emitting more carbon than we're putting in the ground. But that's the stereotypical response toward bovine operations globally, is that we're putting more methane in the atmosphere than we're sequestering into the soil. So to me, that's a non-starter. And it's no fun. I want to have fun when we do. And it's no fun telling my kids, oh, hey, we're actually part of the problem here, but we're organic and grass-fed. That's fine. No, that's BS. That's BS, because that's not a holistic view. And I just believe each of us as a producer has to be, we're culpable. We're culpable for the legacy that we leave, not only our family, but also our communities and the world. We are all culpable one by one. It's not the government who's going to take care of us. It's us who's got to take care of us.
So when I go to Burger King and I get my Whopper, and my Whopper comes from, you know, a CAFO feedlot, whatever.
Yes.
Probably, I'm just guessing, not sequestering a ton of carbon.
Yeah.
And where the headlines are still pointing at cattle farmers and saying that's billions in gas. So what do we do?
First of all, Dana, you got to stop going to Burger King. Just wanted to put that in.
Now what?
It's a tough nut to crack, because for me, after figuring out what we figured out in terms of the spreadsheet and seeing what the numbers said, and going through some feedlot paradigms, they're wrong. It's not okay. It's just not okay to me. And I see them as wrong. I don't think we got it.
Why?
Because they're climate negatives. They're carbon positive and they're climate negatives. You're an idiot if you don't see, when we're driving across the agricultural landscape of America, you don't see tons and tons of exposed soil that's actually more exposed than it's ever been. Even during FDR and the Dust Bowl era, I think we have much more exposed soil than we did then. And he said famously, a nation that destroys its soil destroys itself. We're doing it all over again. We're just calling it something different. Carol and I were driving across southern Idaho last winter, and we did not see one out of thousands, literally thousands of farms in the southern Idaho farm belt all along the Snake River Plain. We did not see one farm with soil covered, unless if it was an alfalfa field. But all the farm fields, whether they be sugar beets, potatoes, corn, those kind of cash crops are important for southern Idaho. They were all 100% exposed in February. It was just exposed soil, and the soil was drifting out of crossroads, just like snow. In fact, they have a word for it down there. It's called snert. It's when snow mixes with dirt, snert.
Glenn has been all across the country, and as an observant person, he notices cows locked in barns, other farms shuttered, the proliferation of certain kinds of trees and not others, soil that's so nutrient weak that it's turned to dust. He sees it and he knows what the problem is.
You know why? It's because we have a chemical agriculture to crutch ourselves through the next season. So yeah, we're going to lose all the life. We're going to volatilize, basically denature and volatilize all those organisms in the soil there because of wind exposure, sun exposure through the winter. And then we're going to replace that all with a chemical agriculture. So this is what the feedlot agriculture is, right? This is what we're creating there. And that's what the problem is, that we've got to stop the bleeding, because the bleeding is real.
How do we do that?
It's one farmer at a time. It's one rancher at a time. It really is. It's people saying, you know what? I don't want to be part of the problem anymore, because governments have tried to do this. Universities have tried to do this, but it's really going to be one farmer, one rancher at a time. You know, just that one thing, Dana, for us, just that one thing. Like on the public lands that we're grazing on, I was talking to somebody about this just today. They said, I want to know about what your grazing rotation is. How long are you on a given piece of ground per unit of time? I said, okay. So our rest period up there on the wild rangelands is 2.5 to 3 years. Okay. That's the average. And they said, okay. So how long are you on a piece of ground? I said, over the 2.5 years with all of our cattle? They said, yeah. So on a given acre, it's about 15 minutes. And they almost dropped the phone. They were like, no, I got that number wrong. It's not 15 minutes. Yeah, I think I heard you say 15. No, I said, no, it's 15 minutes. I said, on a square meter, it's actually, we measure it in seconds per 2.5 years. When we do that, but now we're mimicking all these wild animals that travel in herds. They don't like keep pounding the same over and over again. They're drifting all over the place. It's extremely random. You know, that maybe the wind's pushing them. Maybe wildfire smoke is. Maybe it was Native Americans on horseback. Maybe it was a pack of wolves. Now it's me. It's us trying to mimic those natural rhythms across the landscape. So anyway, that to me is the hope. It's one individual at a time, just taking stock of their situation. And here's the problem, Dana. They're in conventional agriculture. And you know what they're thinking about? They're thinking about leaving the keys on the table and just leaving, taking their wife, their kids, getting the blank out of this place, off this dirt pile, and just absolutely vamoosing and moving someplace completely different, because the intensity of scrutiny from their neighbors and from their relatives is so strong. Are you gonna lose it all? Why can't you do it like Granddad did it? And that's the essence of the problem. The way Granddad did it does not work anymore. It can't in today's economic environment, in today's soil health environment. It can't work. The land cannot produce anymore. And so I want to give them an opportunity to talk to their neighbor and say, wait, you mean I don't have to leave my keys on the table? And you know, even worse, Dana, this guy might be contemplating suicide, because the pressure from family, you know, and friends, the people they go to church with, the people they see at the basketball game, it's so intense.
He's right. Farmers are among the most likely to die by suicide in comparison to other occupations, according to a study published in January 2020 by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The rate was 3.5 times that of the general population.
The scrutiny is so intense, so overwhelming, that they cannot face themselves in the mirror anymore. And they end it. This is why agricultural suicide is on the rise, because it's such a hopeless game when we rely on productivity measures that are created by chemistry, created by chemical inputs to the land. So that's what's wrong with Burger King.
I was going to end our conversation here, but I don't think I can leave you on such a sad note. So I leave you with this. I love to ask farmers their advice about what non-farmers should know about the world of agriculture. Just one thing. Here's Glenn.
I think when we emulate nature, and this is what I want to tell those people, when we emulate nature in agriculture and we work in relationship with it, and it's through humble observation, that's where we got to be here. We got to get off this high horse of, we will make this do this. Instead, if we can just observe and learn from nature, the way nature intends to run these various landscapes we live in, there's an agriculture that's beautiful and harmonious and actually ecosystem like building. And that's what I want people to get the vision of who are not in and around agriculture. There is a hope in agriculture, and there is a hope in real food production. But we do got to pull our head out of this reductionist, mechanistic paradigm and humble ourselves and say, you know what? We need to actually practice an agriculture like nature practices an agriculture. And therein is sustenance for all of us.
A lot of what I get to talk with farmers about ends up on the editing room floor. Not because it's not amazing. It is. But I know I can only hold you hostage here for so long, and I want to give you a tight story, the farmer's story, in a way that's compelling. But some of the tangents we take are fascinating, just remarkable, like Glenn and his possibility math. I love that one in particular. Or his in-depth thoughts on a new book about whether or not we can have sustainable agriculture. You know how jazzed you can be about a new book? Well, I share all of that content and more on a special subscribers-only channel on Instagram. I'm at XOXO Farm Girl, and the subscription is $4.99 a month, just the price of a cup of coffee. And 100% of that fee goes to farmers through a mini-grants process as part of the For Farmers movement. I know you're driving or your hands are soapy, but make a mental note. The next time you're on Instagram, look me up at XOXO Farm Girl. The subscription is so good. It's the hidden, down, and dirty side of Instagram that is so real and so rich. I just want you to be a part of it. Thanks for being here with me and Glenn today on Talk Farm to Me. I love bringing farmers to you, right into your car or your kitchen or on your walk. It's my passion. And it's always 100% honest conversations with serious farmers. And having you here for it is everything. See you next time.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.